Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I'm a film critic and writer, and today I'm delighted to be talking to an old friend of the pod, an old friend of mine now, Tom Schoen. He is the writer of many books, including Blockbusters, a book on Martin Scorsese, a retrospective, and his brilliant biography analysis of Christopher Nolan, the Nolan Variations, which is a superb read and is now available with an updated chapter on Oppenheimer. And given what's happened in the last week or so, you might want to be buying that if you haven't already got a copy, because it's an essential read for anybody who's interested in Christopher Nolan as a filmmaker. Really goes into quite amazing access. You know, Tom's one of the very few people who has had the opportunity to have in-depth interviews with Christopher Nolan, and he really goes deep with it. It's an amazing book. Today, Tom has very kindly agreed to come on board and just talk about the Oscars and also talk about Dune Part 2. I'll always like to get Tom's perspective because of his book Blockbusters, because of his interest in these huge phenomenal films. So that's going to be the topic of our conversation. If you like the episode, please remember to subscribe, leave a review if you can. That always helps. Tell your friends, spread it on social media. Our audience is growing, but it isn't too big, put it that way. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation. What do you want to start with, Tom? Let's start with the Oscars.
I think that's the thing that's kind of like burning through my head at the moment, having just sort of stayed up not so late actually, I guess, now to watch it last night. But what did you think?
It was kind of, usually I did not stay up. I sort of woke up and just read the list of winners and I was like, yep. You know, there was nothing that particularly surprised me or felt an injustice had been done. I was very glad Oppenheimer. It was kind of quite funny how the Barbenheimer thing, Barbie was just left in the dust in terms of everything except like songs. I think I've seen a lot of reaction to Lily Gladstone not winning, and I just think it does a disservice to the whole idea of Lily Gladstone's performance. And also, if you're going to be like that, then don't accept the award ceremonies or the idea of giving an award to anything. Because there was, you know, I mean, The Guardian said Emma Stone's win was a surprise win. I mean, it was neck and neck, wasn't it, until she won?
Yeah.
So, I mean, okay, arguably the second person won, you know, but still, it wasn't like she came out of the blue.
I mean, it was interesting. I think there was this sense, and I now realize that it was a little bit over-exaggerated, that there was something of a backlash going on against Poor Things. You kind of read like accounts of some Academy voters saying they absolutely hated it. And there had just sort of developed over the race a sort of sense that it was more popular in the UK, certainly, and Europe generally, you know, with that kind of slightly punk sensibility of it. And that, you know, in the US, they weren't quite as sort of fond of it. So, and then that coupled together with that, we know their kind of history of wanting to make history, so to speak, and give Lily Gladstone an award thus the first Native American winner. And the narrative had certainly swung a little bit in her favor, but you never know how close these things are. And most of them are a lot closer than we think, I think, you know, like we're, yeah, and it was an interesting moment that they went with Emma Stone. And it's Lily Gladstone's performance was so unlike the usual kind of performance that they reward. You know, it was quiet and still and powerful, you know, rather than big and bold and noisy. You know, like there was nothing Oscar-y about it. So it was always something perhaps a little bit surprising that they'd, you know, that they were going to give it to her. But whereas Emma Stone's performance was almost like, you know, it was very, you know, it made me think of Natalie Portman winning for Black Swan. It was like this big sort of stark deconstruction, you know, like it was very, she was a great, let's turn this movie star inside out kind of performance, you know, and that they do love that. So, you know, it was sort of interesting seeing the Academy not hewing to the sort of narrative we have for it. But I also wonder too whether the internationalism of the body now, the Academy's got more international, and it's going, so it felt a little bit like they were a little bit less beholden to kind of American internal politics, if you like, and you know, and more open to, if you like, more European flavors, like kind of Poor Things. And I wondered whether that was perhaps a factor, you know, in why so many people got it wrong anyway, not in like who won, but like why we were thrown off course a little bit. You know, so I think that was certainly the biggest surprise for me, you know, watching it. And the rest, as you say, you know, was very much a kind of coronation for Chris Nolan, and, you know, long overdue. And
your boy did good.
Yeah, I know. I was so touched because he, you know, he got up there, and I haven't really seen that much of him and Spielberg together, and I don't know what their relationship is like, but he certainly gave him a big old hug. And, you know, Spielberg, of all people, you know, knows what it is to be out in the wilderness for many, many years. I mean, we all think of him as the big success story with Schindler's List, but there was a whole decade and a half of being ignored and slighted, and, you know, for Jaws and E.T. and Raiders of the Lost Ark and all these other films. And he really, really did not get in. And for much the same reason that Nolan hasn't as well, which is, you know, basically they saw him as being this very kind of commercial filmmaker of blockbusters, and, you know, there was the sort of the smell of commerce over those films somehow, and that put them off, you know, even though you look at them now and you're like, why on earth did E.T. not win? So Spielberg giving him director felt very significant to me, and Nolan did seem very moved, almost tearful, I think. He was very visibly moved, and his way of putting it when he accepted was, you know, that he had been, that it was gratifying to be considered part, a small part of the history of the the medium, which is a very him way of looking at it. He's definitely got very, he thinks very historically, and you know, from the outside in, so to speak. But I also thought to myself, well, his part, his, you know, his place in history was sort of already assured. The significance of this is actually that he was kind of being given the final embrace by his sort of peers, and that was visibly moving to him. But yeah, it was very, it was from that point of view very satisfying. But you're right. I mean, Barbie was very much, I the way, the reason I didn't think, like, I felt like Greta Gerwig should have certainly won a sorry, got a nomination for directing it. It's ridiculous that she's been slighted twice for Little Women and for this. So there's definitely something going on there that's a little fishy. I didn't expect it beyond that to kind of win huge, but it was slightly embarrassing that they were obviously using it so much to get their viewers back, you know, and they were, it was, Barbie was front and center as part of the arsenal of weapons they were now trying to use to kind of save the Oscars, but they weren't going to actually give it that many, you know, like it was, there was some, there was a double standard at work a little bit, like
Yeah,
they're
this is
gonna,
what you want to see. This is the entertaining musical numbers that you really want to see.
And then giving it a body swerve at all the key moments, you know, like, you know. But that said, I was very pleased to see it, all the sort of players and the interaction with Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling was excellent. And
But I mean, even their big moment, Barbie's big moment, seemed to be like centered around Ryan Gosling as well. Which I think is the irony of that film, is that
well,
it's this feminist comedy, if you like,
yeah.
and yet its most successful elements is talking about sort of the male, the sort of the men.
Yeah, I mean, that irony kind of cuts right to the middle of the film, doesn't it? Because I think watching it, you would think, you thought to yourself, he's somehow, that this is the more entertaining turn, and these dance numbers are the more, you know, the best bit of the film. So yeah, that is an irony, and it kind of, I don't know kind of what we do with that, but yeah, it was very, you know, him and Mark Ruffalo together, they were kind of carving out a place for the men, you know, these kind of narcissistic comic turns in these, you know, feminist movies. And they're kind of, I think of those performances as strangely twinned in a kind of way. They were both Kens, you know, both Kens in Barbie Land.
I'd not thought of that pairing. That's very true. That's very true.
But I'm fond of them for that reason. You know, they were being good allies and good sports, and you know, and very funny. I think, like, they both of them had the advantage of sort of, if you like, coming from behind and sort of, you know, you weren't expecting them to be the main, you know, the main show. And it was, I thought, in both cases, like, really riotous to see them send up these guys with some affection.
Talking about humor, I just didn't want to get too far away from Spielberg there, because I thought actually watching a lot of the clips back from the, he kept being called upon as sort of like almost a comedy audience member, and I thought he was excellent. He has this sort of like avuncular charm as he twinkles, you know,
Definitely
Kate McKinnon referencing him and everything. It was great.
the nude photos that she'd sent him, and that was the probably the best of his bits, because he, yeah, he underplayed it. I mean, it was just a brilliant reaction shot of just him looking slightly kind of, you know, like beleaguered in the camera. He knew exactly what to do. Yeah, no, there was something very, there was something very kind of soft, twinkly and avuncular about him, wasn't he? Wasn't there? But yeah, it's nice to see him there, even if, you know, I don't think Maestro was ever going to, you know, to get much. But, you know, along with Flowers of the Killer Moon, Killers of the Flower Moon, both came away kind of without, you know, without winning anything. So, you know, yeah, they hewed to their nominations. The ones, the films with the most nominations tended to, you know, to get the love.
I mean, Zone of
That's it.
Interest, I think, is a United Kingdom. I mean, it shows a little bit how, as you were saying, about how international these films are and how the nation of origin is no longer quite as,
Yeah.
especially in Europe, where every film festival I go to, I cover co-productions. You know, every single industry meeting is about how do we get money from different places to make films which can compete. So, you know, Switzerland doesn't want to make Swiss films. It wants to make co-productions. Everywhere wants to make co-productions. So, you know, I thought Zone of Interest as well was, for me, one of the most moving moments of the whole ceremony was Jonathan Glazer's speech, which I've seen has been weaponized by the far right into saying what he did not say, which was he refutes the weaponization of his Jewishness and the Holocaust to justify the occupation, not that he refutes his Jewishness and the Holocaust, which,
right,
you know, is what it's being read as in bad faith by some people.
Yeah, it was a slightly, it was a great moment, and I understood the sentiment. I remember getting slightly thrown by the phrasing, actually. There was a slightly knotty sentence that in there, but I did love the Zone of Interest's win. I mean, it was the second most exciting win, and really good night for British film directors with him and Nolan winning after the last person I think to win was Tom Hooper for the King's Speech in whenever it was, 2010, and, you know, and then two come along. And, the Zone of Interest was, I think, a sort of magnificent film, like many people said. And, yeah, the kind of growing internationalism, and also the other sort of story of the night for me was the number of first-time winners, you know, people who had just been nominated for their first time. I mean, I didn't count it, but there just seemed an awful lot. Every other one was, you know, there were not a lot of, it wasn't so much normally there's this sense of the changing of the guard of the old pros mixing with the young ones. But I really felt like the number of old pros, so to speak, was very limited in the sense that, like, Downey Jr. was the only one who'd been nominated before that won, and the other three were all first timers. And that kind of pattern and that sort of proportion seemed to sort of bear out in some of the other races as well. And you were just seeing a lot of kind of basically young talents kind of, you know, get up on the stage, and that was exciting, and it looked like they'd done a good job of rejuvenating themselves as an awards body. So I don't know what the viewing, you know, is they're going to be like. I'm going to guess they're definitely going to be higher than last few years, certainly.
And I think on the back of Barbenheimer, as you say, I think people were excited for that. People were excited for Lily Gladstone. That was a possible historic moment. That, you know, it's a competition. Things are, you know, unless you're going to tape it and the way I did and find out the results already and then watch it without any tension or anxiety, like Zeus.
Like Zeus.
Yeah, I'm not somebody who goes hugely for the Oscars, but it is an important moment in the year. It is an important moment in the calendar, and a lot of discussions come up as this. So I think it's valuable in that sense.
I mean, it gets a lot of movies made in the sense that, like, a lot of those winners will now go off and get their dream projects sort of financed, and sometimes it's not the best. The number of sort of screenwriters that have come away with that trophy and then gone and blown it with some, you know, movie that they've directed. But I don't want to be, you know, rain on the parade. Let's hope they all do make great, good movies. But it definitely has an effect on, like, kind of production, and that, you know, there'll be a kind of slew of productions that now start because of that night. You realize one of the realized things that I love about it, and I really like that they brought back the sort of chorus of your peers effect, give each of the nominees a little bit of a toast before awarding the final acting honor. And that to me is like the honey of the whole thing. Like, that's really what you're after, because we look at these actors, these movie stars on screen, and they're very, we see them at their most polished, even when they're being raw. And I find this something absolutely fascinating in seeing them reacting live in real time to, actual praise in this case that hits home. And you're seeing an unrehearsed emotion, and that to me is fascinating. I love that, that kind of segment. And I felt like there were some good ones in there. There were some good roasts as well. Sam Rockwell, I think, was funny. And, but some of them were kind of, there was some good joking going on.
Nicolas Cage was, would I have done that? Well, yes, obviously I would have.
Yeah. And, you know, and then that moment you saw Paul Giamatti just totally react, and keep the gag going with Nicolas Cage spontaneously, and you saw something of his skill and his personality too in that moment. You know, he was absolutely game for that joke. He was totally in there. So yeah, I love those moments. I really hope they keep that. But yeah, it was certainly gonna. There must have been a few drinks in Cork, Ireland, to celebrate Cillian Murphy's win.
And that's such a warranted win as well. I mean, if a performance ever carried a film, I mean, it doesn't need carrying as a film because it's got every element, but it
Very
is
true.
such a keystone in the huge cathedral of that film that has
Yeah.
to be there.
It's very, you know, I can't think of an example where a performance has been so in lockstep with the direction of a film as his performance is with Nolan's direction in that film, in that there is a lot of editing, you know, there's a lot of montage editing where Oppenheimer's kind of haunted face is cut in with various subatomic reactions going on. And the performance, so to speak, is being kind of generated by a mixture of the two, you know, and, you know, it's the old sort of Hitchcock thing of just cutting between James Stewart and what he's looking at. And then, you know, we infer, oh, well, in this shot, James Stewart's being a creepy old man. This shot, he's being dreamy, or, you know, the Kuleshov effect, right? And it's kind of like there's lots of that going on in Oppenheimer. And, you know, and Nolan, I think, really needed an actor who was going to collaborate with him and be in working kind of lockstep with him. And, you know, and I think that Murphy did that absolutely brilliantly. And when I think of the kind of performance of that film, you know, when I think about the sort of presence of sort of Oppenheimer and how it's kind of conjured, I do think of it as the work of Murphy, Nolan, his editor. You know, like they're all in concert, you know, which is kind of just great movie acting. So, and it takes a very kind of supple and, you know, in a funny kind of way, only a character actor, if I can call him that, you know, like could have done it. Like a star may not have had the suppleness to kind of work that closely with a director who's saying, because I would imagine that some of those scenes took a lot of, you know, when he's in bed at night and he's seeing these visions. I mean, I know it, in fact, some of them they actually did, they conjured them for him on set. So he was looking at something. But it's a little bit of variant of the green screen phenomena where you're very dependent on your director to essentially tell you what you're acting with, you know, like kind of what are you doing in the scene. So yeah, like a, just a really, and he seems such a sort of modest fellow, doesn't he? You know,
Absolutely.
genuinely kind of overwhelmed and pleased and just gobsmacked by the win, which, and it was always nice to see, you know, it's sort of so yeah, that
And
was a.
he's sort of been someone who's been in the trenches for a long time, doing a lot of work, a lot of great work. And you just feel he's also mature enough to have that success now and it not to sort of hit it, knock him off course at all. You know, I feel that he'll use that success in a very clever way. Just by watching his behavior during this whole crazy Oscar season, he's kind of kept everything kind of a little bit at arm's length, a little bit,
True.
under the radar, even, I saw a photograph of him on Twitter, sort of getting photographs taken with the Aer Lingus hostess that took him across to New York, and it just seems like that's the sort of thing he'll allow, but he won't be, he
Yeah.
doesn't want much more than that.
No, you don't see it kind of going straight into his blood. Sometimes the wind kind of goes straight into the bloodstream and and you can see. You know, the expect, you know, sometimes you could see the actor kind of rising to sort of drink it in, you know, and it's kind of like he wasn't doing any of that. It just seemed, some of this just seemed crazy to him. And so you didn't sense that kind of huge ego at work. Whereas I say, then you look at Robert Downey Jr. and you're like, he had sort of pre-milked that moment 1,000 times in his head. Like he's kind of, that's his kind of cocky, like, sort of charisma, isn't it? Like he's a he's a kind of classic. I mean, he's very talented. I'm not trying to take anything away from him at all, but like he's a classic narcissist in that sense. Like he absolutely, has lived this moment many times, and then sort of, but nonetheless, even he kind of managed, I think, to get to this sort of sincere place when accepting. Actually, it's when he's talking about his wife. I never get like I always level with thanks. I sort of think too, like he was kind of revealing, and in his case, you really kind of got to like the sort of heart of it with that image of him as this rescue pet that had been taken in. It was funny, but there's also something there the way you're like, oh, I see. That's I can see this relate why this relationship is so significant, and like it's very. So even cocky Robert Downey Jr. kind of got to a sort of sincere place in his sort of speech.
He sort of buries it, doesn't he? There's a little bit as well where he says, I needed this role more than the film needed me. And
That's
I
right.
thought
See.
that was a really, if you'd got rid of a lot of the other sort of, I want to thank my lawyer for getting me out of jail and my stylist who never gets any, and just left those two observations, the wife and the fact that he really needed this much more than it needed him. I think those
Yeah,
were the
that's
two
right.
moments of, I mean, maybe too unbearable, but that you need the jokes in order to allow you to say that.
There you go. I mean, it's very like his performances, actually. I mean, there's lots of sort of pyrotechnics and sort of dancing on the head of a pin, and then, but then he kind of lets, he kind of lands the plane, So it's, all these, I always love those speeches. And sometimes the gushier the better.
Halle
I don't
Berry at the Razzies.
know. No, I sort of, I always sort of thought that as I say, the sort of raw, unedited emotion that you're seeing, there's nothing phony about it. It may be unpleasing, so I think kind of there's a British thing, isn't there, of like not wanting to see people. At that point, I think there's a certain squeamishness about seeing somebody who's nursed an ambition suddenly see it realized, and then so I remember like reading lots of takes in my youth where like the Oscars would get nailed for that, it was just all but I was I definitely always loved it, and I always thought that the emotion was genuine. But it's very, but it's, but the speeches are a sort of form in themselves. I mean, like you begin to, like I watched a lot of them because of the season is so long, and you kind of, you look forward to certain people's speeches. I actually always did enjoy Nolan's. I thought that they were very, they were unusually emotional, not unusually, but they were just uncharacteristically emotional. And obviously, just well written. And yet there was a sort of calm to them at the same time.
You've got to be working on an updated edition of your book, surely.
Well, I've done an updated version with Oppenheimer in it.
Ah, right, that's already been done, right?
Did that, and sort of, because I saw it, just before it came out, and he was kind of the happiest I've sort of seen him. He was sort of very, and I now realize it was because I think it was because he knew what he'd done. He was very brilliant with to show it, and so we got into the nooks and crannies of Oppenheimer, and had sort of vigorous back and forth. I kind of had a our one. It wasn't a big disagreement, but we had a difference of opinion in that I think I had a different take on his guilt. I remember s that Chris had a, he was a little bit more cynical about the how sincere it was. And I think that comes, well, certainly the Strauss character gets to express his cynicism about how insincere he thinks it is. And I think too, the Kitty expresses at one point, she sort of says that, did you think that just because you allow them to tar and feather you, they were going to forgive you? So you got both of those characters sort of suggesting that it was not an act exactly, but certainly self-serving of him to, after the fact, publicize his, second thoughts about nuclear energy. And I don't, I completely concede that. I can totally see that after the fact is certainly too late and risks the reaction of, well, who cares, you know? But I also felt like, you know, we were watching a man awaken to how guilty he genuinely did feel. And I did sort of think of the whole film as just a sort of study in kind of guilt.
I mean, you can have genuine guilt and utilize it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which was my sort of, I watched the film twice, and I think the first time I watched it, I thought, I kind of don't like the bit which feels like you're triumphing over Strauss in order to, yeah, you're the real villain. Good on you, Oppie. You know, and that's... I just thought, well, wait a minute, didn't he actually, you know, make the atomic bomb? And then by the end, you get that. The sort of point of the film, I guess. But then the second time I watched it, I felt, oh no, Strauss is nailing Oppenheimer all the way through, and Strauss's fall does not negate any of the validity of what he's saying.
I totally agree with that. And I too shift back and forth between those two takes when I'm watching it and rewatching it. And I think that that's a quality that it shares with The Prestige and... you know, in that you've got like two protagonists who are each other's villains, and you know, you can kind of look at it from one angle or the other, and it doesn't ever seem to settle, you know. And I think that's an admirable quality. I think it's kind of it gives the film depth, but it is certainly, you know, it's unusual because, yeah, I had the same thing with, it's such a weird, you know, interesting ending, because as you say, it's got this kind of movie-ish ending that allows him to triumph. And at the same time, he's damned, you know, like it's kind of like you know, it's very, that ambivalence is very, it's very unusual and key to the film, but.
It's a dialectic without synthesis. You know, you even have the lawyer character saying, oh, maybe he wasn't talking about you at all. Maybe he was talking about something more important. And you think, yeah, in your face. And then you see what they were talking about. And it was like, oh, yeah, his sins were far greater than your office politics.
Yeah, you know, that's right.
But they were sins, you know. It's like getting Al Capone for not paying his taxes.
That's right. Yeah, no, definitely. And I think, it's very... I definitely see there's a room. It felt like there was, he's got a great sense of, I think, sin. I mean, you think those kind of early crime pictures of his wouldn't have worked without a sense of sin, of sinfulness. You know, the best crime films do. And I think kind of Nolan's films do too. But this one in particular.
There's a kind of Catholicism to it almost as well. I mean, it's sin from a...
I mean, his background is Catholic. His dad was, he's not religious, but his dad was Catholic and sent him to a kind of Catholic school. So the certainly the kind of the backdrop, the same kind of backdrop, you know, that you find in Hitchcock. So it's very in that sense, you know, it's there. It's in the air. It's in the molecules, even if he isn't himself religiously observant. No, it's funny. I had we were sort of talking to a Japanese film crew because it's being released in Japan now, and they came to sort of talk to us about it, and it was very sort of. I'm fascinated to see how it's. I think it's later this month to see how well it does, or you know what the reaction is. I found it impossible to say or to kind of speculate as to what it might be. You know, I kind of gather that there's a slight generational difference, that the older generation are more suspicious of it, a little bit more careful around the subject on film, not sure that they want to see it. And the younger generation seem more open to it, and they've often, you know, the young man who is doing the, you know, the interview was sort of a Nolan fan. I mean, he'd seen Interstellar, you know, like there was a, and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, of course, there'll be sort of Nolan, you know, there'll be sort of Nolan, Japanese Nolan fans who are just sort of like keen to see it as a Nolan film. Yeah, it was interesting. And an interesting moment at the Oscars too, when Godzilla won. And, you know, and then I think there were some backstage photographs of sort of their special effects guy and Nolan sort of, with their Oscars together, and it made a kind of, that had a certain sort of poetic justice to it, with this radioactive lizard and Oppenheimer kind of making peace after the ceremony, not to trivialize the whole thing. But
do you think with this win, Nolan will be able to finally make the films he wants to make?
Yeah, that's funny. It's very, you know, that's always been there's something very kind of disciplined. He's very sort of self-disciplined, isn't he? Like, because the sky has been the limit, and for him, you know, and so the question has always been, well, how do I impose the limits that I need in order to kind of creatively flourish? Yeah, I don't know what he's going to do. I'm guessing there's going to be something a bit more kind of commercial, or not more commercial. What am I saying? But what I mean is a swing more towards the Inception end of things, and the James Bond. He was interested in Bond. I don't think he's going to do it. I think a little bit more in tone, a little bit more kind of summer blockbuster. You know,
it was a genre. You know, more.
Yeah, exactly, and. I mean, does Oppenheimer does end on this incredibly dark note, you know, very unusually for like a summer film, certainly, and also unusually really for an Oscar film. But it's sort of, but yeah, I can easily see as much as he does swing that other direction, I think there'll be a swing.
So now we can talk about next year's Oscars and Dune Part Two. This is one of the rare sequels, I think, which improves the first film. It's not just better than the first film necessarily for me, but it also makes the first film a better film. But what was your take on it?
I totally agree with that. Yeah, like it the first film needed the second one to come along and sort of, because they're sort of all enveloping movies, aren't they? Like sensorily, they just sort of take you over, and it certainly works for being an expanded universe. And yeah, I mean, technically the film, I mean, narratively, I felt the film worked better. It had a kind of a clearer sort of story, you know, to it. I felt there was a lot of kind of preamble in the first one, which I was still very impressive, but you did get the sense that he was holding sort of certain things back, some of the better stuff. And in the second one, we definitely got it. I was super impressed with it. While at the same time having a few reservations about Timothée Chalamet, you know, I did. It's interesting. I enjoy. So he certainly. There's nothing wrong with his performance. He's, you know, he. But I found myself enjoying the other performances more, and I kind of Zendaya's sort of her skepticism about that character, about Paul, is to me like where I go emotionally. And you know, her ambivalence about this rather flash Harry Prince figure is, I kind of feel, a very real ambivalence that, you know, it's certainly mine and maybe other members of the audience too, about him as a character, as an actor. Is he to be trusted entirely? Is he a callow young man? And so I feel like she's the kind of emotional fulcrum of it, and I hope that the third film realizes that. I feel like it will. It feels like it's setting that up really, really well, you know. But I also thought that Austin Butler was just standout, just as a piece of kind of movie acting. I mean, that character wholly, you know, takes you over, and I loved him and I loved the character, and I just wanted more of him to tell the truth. And I think
he has that thing, that danger that I remember Darth Vader, when I first watched those as a kid, scared the bejesus out of me, because he literally could do anything. You know, when he was on the screen, someone was going to die. You just get the feeling with Austin Butler as well, that anything could happen when he was around.
There's this kind of weird thing that started happening with the Marvel movies, whereby there's a narrative problem comes with like these very compelling bad guys. I remember this was very true. There was Mickey Rourke's Iron Man. Was it that Iron Man 2?
It's
a fantastic bad guy who gets introduced, and then they have to kind of ignore him for like large portions of the movie, Because, well, what are you going to do if you can't battle in too soon, or else the movie's going to be over? We know that their climactic battle is going to be the climax of the movie. So basically, they're twiddling their thumbs for like three hours. And I kind of felt that, that Austin Butler's character had that effect a little bit. And it was smart in a way of him to introduce him only halfway through the film, because the moment he's in the film, you are sort of fast tracking towards their confrontation. And but yeah, that's the problem. I mean, Darth Vader, they introduce him, and but then Darth Vader, there are a series of chases, aren't there? Star Wars is a series of chases, isn't it? And he's also building the Death Star. So there's all this sort of stuff that he's doing before he gets to confront Obi-Wan Kenobi, or in the second film, Luke. And whereas some of the more recent villains, I mean, their main job is going to be to fight the hero. So yeah, how do you put that off for 3 hours? It's
It's
difficult.
like James Bond always has that thing of having, at least two henchmen that you can be. Can also often, in the case of Jaws, be more memorable than the actual villain,
Yeah. Well, I mean, in some ways, Darth Vader is that henchman, isn't he? Because the Emperor who's pulling the strings. And you kind of it's interesting, like he's a lord, he's you could easily imagine. I wonder whether he dreamt him up, whether there might have been a case of just like, well, the Emperor's the main guy, I'm just going to invent this kind of this lord, he's going to be low-lying figure, we'll just put him in and see what happens. He might well have just taken the thing over, but yeah, no, definitely the henchman is the way to go. But yeah, Austin Butler was great. I loved it. Like, you really felt the intimacy of those knife fights. Like, people always say that, but the fighting with a knife, killing somebody, all this sort of stuff is very intimate, and it's sort of like, in a way that kind of guns are not, and even swords, are not. And you really felt that when he kind of came in close with his kind of, his sort of opponents. I had little flashbacks to there's a knifing in Saving Private Ryan that just feels just. Do you remember when he goes to the top in the room and the German leaps on him and he drives that thing down into him? And it's just extremely close, these two figures. I really felt that with him too in Dune
It's the
too.
Jewish soldier as well, whose name I forget, and he's sort of begging
Yeah,
with him as well. He's sort of
that's
going,
right.
don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And the
That's
German's
right.
going, it's okay, it's okay. It's it's not, he's speaking
Just
German, but
forget.
he's sort of saying, it's not gonna hurt, don't worry, don't worry,
Go to sleep.
Exactly. It's really
Yeah.
that's so good. And I think it's also Chalamet's best bit, because he becomes when he gets himself stabbed, I think that's one of
Yeah.
the
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The nicest ways of doing that, it's often again, it's like a formulaic problem. You know the hero's going to win. You know this, there's only going to be one winner. So how are we going to get to that win? And you actually
Yeah.
do introduce like, oh, maybe he isn't going to win, you
You're
know?
right. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's interesting. Like, he's very his physique is very, he's a thin Edward Scissorhands like young man, isn't he? Like,
He's quite tall. I've met him in real. I've interviewed him, and he's a tall chap. More than you'd expect.
He's got a kind of poet's physique, basically, hasn't he? He's Byronic. And there's a, yeah, I wasn't that, I think that's where the slight doubt for me comes in, because I sort of think, is he kind of, is he sort of, does he have that athleticism that is required of this part. I mean, everybody seems to be, delighted with him. So it may be just an old kind of film critics kind of, sort of complaint. So, it might work for people. But there's no question that I think if he can round this out, if, Villeneuve can, round out the third film, it's definitely in competition in the same way that The Lord of the Rings was, and sort of Peter Jackson. I mean, it is, and people did point this out, it is very exciting to see younger, basically a movie filled with younger movie stars, like they're all kind of carrying it. Definitely a mixture of the old and the new guard, but it's just superbly cast, right across the board. It's just a wealth of really good and really kind of precisely cast as well. Like, I'm pleased that they're bringing casting in as an Oscar, because I think, he's going to do well in that kind of category, as he would do in direction. I sort of see that they're definitely directors' movies. And I can sort of, I'm definitely intrigued by him as a, as one of those blockbuster auteurs. He's got a sensibility. It's great. They're fantastic designs. I don't know where it comes from in his background at all, but he's Canadian, isn't he? But it's like, it's very kind of ergonomic. It's very smooth. It's very textured. There are no knobs and dials in his spaceships. They're all like Apple botches, they're very, I sometimes think of it, it's like those movies are like a cross between Leni Riefenstahl and the Apple Store, they're very it's just that you don't know whether you're being asked to admire the new galactic kind of order or buy a new watch or something.
I think they really went into that medieval sense of that you get from the books as well, of the barons and the, and it's the first time I've ever seen like spaceships with carpets. There's a bit in the very first one where like a ramp comes down and it's carpeted. It's like, okay. And they seal letters with wax. And I love the Florence Pugh sort of, giving her diary, and it's some sort of inscription device that is sort of chiseling it into metal. Yeah, it's all very tactile. And I really got a feeling that there was a reason behind all this, rather than, why don't they just use lasers instead of using swords all the time? And it was like, no, there's a real reason behind all of this. I trust the filmmaker. I trust the story.
That's interesting. I hadn't spotted the carpets. That's fantastic. That's such a good detail. Yeah, no, it's very, it's, and I think half of it is just as sort of textural objects, as like kind of textural experiences. They're sensational. You just submit to the sand and the wind and the imagined feel of all that stone and the coolness of those underground caverns, and then the beauty of those shafts of sunlight that come down. There's definitely a look. There are some similar chasms and sort of sunlight shafts in the Blade Runner movie. I kind of remember some of the ending of that reminds me a lot of some of Dune. And that's Deakins, isn't it, who sort of loves those sort of light effects. But the but yeah, he's very...
The knife fight as well at the end reminded me very much of where Rick Deckard interviews Rachel in the first film. It had that same sort of
interesting
background to the city, which is obviously not Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, not Denise. But it felt very much like that similar sort of framing of the environment.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think... I can certainly see why he did the Blade Runner film. I mean, and there's definitely a similarity with Scott. They both create these kind of environments, don't they, that you just want to sort of dive into and exist in. And Scott was kind of one of the first directors, I feel, of like the modern era to sort of happen across this kind of phenomenon that we now are very familiar with, of like the world of the movie being the thing that's as important as anything else. And as the story, and you just want to kind of go in there and nose around and explore it a little bit. Like, I always think that the really key scene in Blade Runner is like when Deckard is using that photo enhancer, that voice activated photo enhancer, to go and then the picture comes up and it seems to be able to look around corners. You know, it's like an amazing device that somehow is photographically, you're going into that scene. And that is very, very Scott, but it's also very kind of modern, and it's very, it's how we use computers now. It's how we explore movies now. And Villeneuve is definitely like the sort of modern inheritor, I think, of those kind of big movie environments where, I mean, there were points in it, I think, you know, and it's largely to the music. There were sort of points of it which were very kind of purely cinematic in the sense that I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure exactly what narratively might have been going on, but I just remember being blasted and soaring on like a wave, a bed of synthesizers, and then, you know, and the visuals of the sand and so on. And I sometimes I would catch myself and kind of go, well, actually, hang on, what is happening at this point?
Where are we going? We're on top of a giant worm. Where exactly are we supposed to be?
And of course, it doesn't really matter. You should just kind of go with it. But I did, you know, there's an interstitial kind of vagueness sometimes about like kind of what sort of narratively is sort of happening. But that's okay. But yeah, it's these great blasting kind of sequences, which are very, very cinematic. So yeah, very pleased. Did it do well? I can't remember. Is it like?
Oh, it's doing phenomenally well. I think it's on track to be the Barbie of this year. I mean, it's very early days, but it's making hundreds and hundreds of millions per day. You know, and it won't be long before it's hitting the billion mark. I mean, we've got to the point where the billion mark is no longer this sort of, you know, far out, you know, thing. I totally agree with what you said about Zendaya. I thought she is the MVP of the film, in the sense that, you know, that internet meme, look at someone the way such and such looks at so and so. And it's like, it's entirely, you're looking at everything through her eyes. And totally believe in the love affair because of her. You know, and because of the way she looks at him and that kiss. And I was just thinking, you know, I haven't seen a kiss in like a popular entertainment movie that I actually was like, yeah, go for it, guys. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a really romantic thing. And romance is not necessarily something you would consider.
That's interesting. I can remember like shouting at the screen in like The Last Jedi, because there was a moment where I thought that Adam Driver, should have kissed her. And it's right when there's a battle. So he basically suddenly reveals his turning. He turns. He becomes briefly to the side of the good, and he joins Rey for a lightsaber battle where they take down. Do you remember that giant red room with the
Elvis samurai comeback special?
Yeah, yeah, fantastic scene. And you know, like, and they basically just kind of slice and dice their way through the entire room full of these sort of samurai. And it's like, and I was literally on my seat shouting at the end of it. Then I swear the movie audience I was with would have exploded if only at the end of that fight he'd taken her and there'd been a kiss between them, or she'd taken him and there'd been a kiss between them. And I felt like it took them a long time to get to it in the, you know, in the third one. But yeah, there's definitely, there's an absence, I think, of like, of certainly those sort of big adventure movies of fashioning them around the, you know, that they have a kind of romantic story to them. I don't, maybe because they've just been for too long ingrained in a sort of male adolescent sensibility, and there's a certain, you know,
yuck, there is kissing.
Yeah, that's right. And so there's certainly, I don't really remember. I do remember that like Iron Man, in the first couple, you know, with Gwyneth Paltrow and Robert Downey Jr., there's a little bit of electricity, but that's about all. I do remember it just kind of just getting drummed out of the series.
Yeah, Marvel is remarkably sexless. I mean, it's like people get married maybe, but they don't have sex.
There's not much going on there, but it's like, So yeah, definitely, it feels like a that feels like a, an absence in our movie-going lives, doesn't it? Because Harrison Ford and and Carrie Fisher, particularly in The Empire Strikes Back, packed serious heat. That really, had a kind of classic, sort of old movie, kind of feel to it, and golden age stars had their. That was a. I mean, it was written by. Partly by Lee Brackett, who'd written some of those old, those very movies. So that's not surprising, but there was very, and Kasdan too has his sort of feet in the sort of 40s and 50s. So, I definitely feel there's a sort of hunger for that. And there's too much kind of gender zoning of the movies. It's great when I think kind of, when filmmakers kind of snap out of it, or have the ambition certainly to snap out of it and make a what they call a four quadrant movie, where they kind of, which it may be increasingly they'll have to. I mean, there's no question that like Dune could only have really worked and got the money and the go ahead if he had the ambitions to include as many people in the audience as possible. And I'm trying to talk about this in a way that doesn't suggest like romance is just the girls thing or that'll get the kind of female audience in. I don't feel that myself because I know it's me. I would like it to, there to be more romance in these things, but that's certainly how they think. And that's kind of how they, they market the movie.
Well, if anything, I think it's setting up the third movie, which will be based on the second book, Dune Messiah. It's setting up, I think, for Zendaya's character to be the heroine and for Timothée Chalamet's character, Paul Atreides, to be the villain, or to be the someone becoming the villain. I don't see. I mean, the end of the movie. We talked about Oppenheimer early having a dark ending. The end of this movie is like, I've given in to the prophecy that I've known about all along, that if I do this, I will spread war across the galaxy. It'll be a holy war and it'll kill billions of people. But hey ho, off we go, and it's you're seeing like you're within that final battle, even before the knife fight, you see the people you'd be cheering on, the Fremen, becoming the villains, becoming the people who are now going to go to other cities. And all the wars are wars of annihilation. All the wars are wars of genocide. There's no surrender, kill all the guards, bring the prisoners to the And in the current context in which we're watching these films, it struck me, I'm sure this wasn't intentional, obviously, because the film was made, edited and prepared for release long before October the 7th, but it just had so much apparent relevance to today.
That's interesting. You've read the books, haven't you?
Yes.
Do you know, I haven't, do you know, is the material that they're heading towards in the third film, does it darken the Paul Atreides character? And is there room for, Zendaya's character to occupy the space we want her to occupy? Like, is there, how faithful are they? I know that there's a, I'm not sure how they, tell me how faithful they are. They kind of, there's a lot of reorganization going on, isn't there? That's the sense I get.
There are loads of elements that they are, and it's kind of surprising that they've split them into two, and yet there are elements that have gone into the background and disappeared. Like the whole idea is there has been, like there are a couple of things which you get to know through the books, which I don't think are explained in the films, and I don't have any problem with that because they don't have space. But everything you see in the film are supposed to be a diaspora of Earth. So these are not, and this is vastly into the future. So these are not people who look like Arabs. These are actually Muslims who are part of the diaspora, and a Jewish bunch turn up in one of the later books as well. So these are all supposed to be sort of baronial medieval organizations that come from Earth. There's been a war against the thinking machines, and so there's been a move against technology, hence this medieval sort of wax seals and things. Mm-hmm. And like computers are now people. So you saw the guy who would occasionally, all the people who stand around and are doing calculations in their heads, basically. And they're also the navigators who are the other big missing element of the film are the people who are moving people across huge distances of space, and they eat spice and become grotesquely deformed, but are able to navigate across space, and so are hugely important. And this idea is that runs through the books, and it is captured by the film, is the more you need power, the more you want power, the less human you become. And whether that's power to calculate something, you begin to look like a computer, whether you or mm-hmm. navigate space, you begin to look like a monster. Or if it's power to rule people, it means you've got to either become a Harkonnen, or you've got to become a what Paul Atreides becomes in Dune Messiah. Now, I don't think there's much space in Dune Messiah, because Dune Messiah is basically a reply to the people who loved the first book too much, mm-hmm. which was he wanted to go against his sort of Joseph Campbell's story of the hero who's refused mm-hmm. the thing and all the rest of it, and show that he would, you know, Frank Herbert was well aware of the white savior. Well, that mm-hmm. notion is not a modern invention. T.E. Lawrence, mm-hmm. he was basing this on Lawrence of Arabia and T.E. Lawrence and everything. And he wanted to criticize this leader. And so in this, when he saw that the first book, it was just being read as a straightforward space opera. In mm-hmm. the second book, it's all about how that power twists Paul and makes him continuously less human. So mm-hmm. the idea that he marries the emperor's daughter and he keeps Chani on as a mistress, it becomes very much about palace intrigue. And uh-huh. They're all sort of fighting each other. His sister is this super-powered Anna Taylor-Joy character. Uh-huh. And the other thing which is interesting, which I think would be interested in seeing, is Duncan Idaho, the character played by Jason Momoa, actually comes back because his body has been recuperated from the desert and uh-huh. has been sort of reanimated by the Harkonnens. As a, you know, and it's questionable as to whether there is any of Duncan Idaho left inside him. So everybody just is constantly being transformed into something which serves a specific purpose. The, you know, I think that's in this film as well. You know, Paul is almost, you know, Timothy Chalamet, poor bloke, is almost crushed under the weight of all the names he collects as he goes through the, you know, Maudib, the Khazad Hararach, the Islam, you know, it's just a whole bunch of names that he gets.
So he was writing, you know, so tell me, what was the, his sources for this would have been T. Lawrence. He was writing in the 60s?
Yeah, so, early 60s. I think it's early 60s. And by all means, DM me or send me emails if people if I've got much any of this wrong. He was an environmental scientist, and so part of it was about environmentalism. The production of the spice is obviously, you know, the film makes it explicit with Harkonnen taking baths in oil all the time. Mm-hmm. Is like the resources of this impoverished country. Mm-hmm. The idea is that when this guy comes, the green paradise, and green is of course a hugely important color in Islam, the going to the green paradise is making Arrakis into going back to being a normal Earth-like planet, which has been ruined by the production of spice.
That's so interesting. So if you put it against the sort of backdrop of what was going on kind of in the Middle East in that period, that's very interesting. I mean, so America is sort of, you know, is getting more and more involved. There's the history of the British entanglement and disaster in the Middle East kind of hanging over it. And out of that sort of comes Dune. That makes a lot of sense. And it also makes a lot of sense as to why now, like why, to your question, you know, although obviously, you know, what's going on in sort of Gaza, and obviously couldn't have been known by the filmmakers, but generally speaking, there are kind of broad things pushing these films into sort of filmmakers into their interest in these projects and these films in the production. And of course, America's involvement in the Middle East is the huge backdrop of, like, you know, all its foreign policy, you know, after 9/11. So why would it kind of, its movie industry would be interested in channeling some of that. Yeah, it makes it, it's really interesting, you know, to think about it.
I mean, in the books, he uses the word jihad all the way through.
Yeah.
Now, which you know, you can imagine that was day one of the first draft. They took that word out, you know, because Paul leads a jihad, you know. And it's...
Yeah, that's interesting. It's kind of like, yeah, I mean, it's sort of, it's a little bit like, it's part of why it's compelling. It's part of the, it's, it, and I can see he's done the same thing that the Bourne movies did, which is to say, you want the echo of all these, you know, goings on in various parts of the world. You want the shadow, you want the imprint, but you don't want to directly reference it.
Mm.
But, you know, but if you can have, you know, your movie filled with sand, if you can have these kind of jihadist characters, even if they're not called that, yeah, you're kind of, you're hitting on something, you know, you're hitting on the audience's kind of subconscious kind of buttons, aren't you?
Yeah, and don't, let's look at the Fremen as a, as a single monolithic group of people. There are the religious people of the South. There are the more secular people of the North. You've got the PLO. Mm. You've got the, you know, when Chani, Zendaya's character, says, you know, we're all equal, you know, men, women, we're all treated the same. You know, you can imagine certain elements of the audience scoffing at the wokeness of such sentiment. But, you know, 60s, 70s liberation movements would have entirely recognized that idea of the liberation, you know, Che Guevara's guerrillas employing women in fighting positions and what have you.
Yeah, no, for sure. Oh, well, you know, I love hearing about this. I'm more excited for the third one now than I was before, and I was definitely felt like this was a kind of great series that was sort of shaping up.
I mean, I think the first one's really, really well written and a really good book, a really solid. And to your point about world building, which I think I love the idea of that being like Ridley Scott being one of those pioneers of that. I think it's a notion that's a bit irritating when somebody uses the phrase world building, because that immediately makes you, it's like somebody saying, in a way, Los Angeles is really a character in this movie. It's just like, shut up. It's not.
Yeah.
In the books, all the chapters are headed by like quotations from like the Encyclopedia Galacticus and the Bene Gesserit handbook and the diaries of Princess Irulan, daughter of the Emperor. So you have all of these quotes before you even meet the characters or the societies or the, you know, and you just get this idea. This is one book in a library of books, in a library that's in a city, that's on a planet, that's in a galaxy, mm-hmm. that's in a universe. And it just mm-hmm. extends on. And that's what, you know, when I read it when I was, God, I was like 11 or 12 or something, and then reread it, alternating with Lord of the Rings, you know, those were my sort of texts.
Well, yeah, I mean, the world building is sort of like in sort of modern movie parlance, it's definitely a cliche, isn't it? But it's also very similar to, as you've just sort of said, the way that young children first read and the way they first explore books and films. You know, your devotion to it is absolute. You disappear into that that book, that film, whatever it might be. So it's very instinctive, I think, to young children, even if it's now become kind of, you know, corporate, corporate strategy. But yeah, I mean, I did that, you know, too. For me, it was C.S. Lewis. I remember kind of diving into those books. And they're quite short, actually. So they, you know, like... I had to do a lot of rereading, but yeah, like that. Now, I mean, they've sort of realized that level of immersion is kind of the thing that draws people back, isn't it? It's the return audience. That's the key to it, because, you know, no, things are not standalone movies anymore. So they want to kind of breed that kind of same sense of loyalty to place, almost, where you just want to keep returning, and you're a repeat customer, which is sort of exactly by definition kind of what they want.
I mean, I think you can see the extreme form of that, and maybe it's sort of reductio ad absurdum in the Star Wars and what Disney are doing with Star Wars now, where it's like, is there a planet we haven't been on in this galaxy? And, you know, is there a side character? Is there a moment in the lives of any of these characters that we don't know about now with the prequels and TV shows? And
I
thought Kenobi was like an old man in the desert who was there for years. And no, but apparently, according to the TV series, he was off having adventures all the time, every 5 minutes. Right. And nobody noticed.
Yeah, we've definitely lost, in the process of this, you know, we've lost the idea of the evocative detail that sort of stays a detail, that isn't a film in its own right. You know, and I do remember that sort of was part of the pleasure of Star Wars, was hearing reference to all these things, but that wasn't the point. The point was, you know, if you heard about the spice mines of Kessel, it was vaguely thrilling. Particularly, I guess, if you're a Dune reader, because you're
exactly,
like,
hey,
but you know,
lots of characters named after Dune people as well. Princess Leia is a Dune character. Sandy comes from a sandy place.
Of course,
you know,
So, I mean, I always felt that too, particularly with like the Alien films, because I remember thinking that like that this thing was just so lethal that you just sort of stumbled across it, and a single unimportant spore, you know, of this genetic line would sort of wipe you out. And then, then to see even Scott, when he goes back to it, just sort of reinterpreting that entire first accidental. That's it. There's a lack of accidents. You know, nobody sort of stumbles across and accidentally finds anything anymore. It's sort of predestined. The trouble with that universe way of thinking is that everything is now predestined, and you come at these things and you realize that, like, well, Luke was on Tatooine and everybody was watching him. And he was never stuck in the boondocks at all. It was just, he was this sort of prize possession that you know, people were sort of checking in on all the time. And there's something, there's something a little disappointing, you know, because that to me was the point of connection into this adventure was, oh yeah, okay, so you're stuck in some backwater, but you could join the rebellion, you know. There's definitely something kind of goes. There's also, you know, I totally get it. Like, you know, to want to sort of dive in and sort of disappear into these worlds, it's sort of, it is childlike. It's very, there's a certain, if it's done right, there's a certain kind of purity to it. And I do think, like, when Scott was doing it first, I don't think he was thinking, I know he wasn't thinking, oh, this is going to be, the franchises didn't, there was no thought of an Alien movie, sequel. There's no sort of a Blade Runner sequel. It just so happens that he was sort of just of that temperament that just delighted in the textures and sounds of these worlds, and almost did it too well, you know, and then these films just commanded us to kind of go back to them. So yeah, there's an element of kind of accident there, you know, as he discovers that this is a skill that he has and that it's important to people. But we didn't know what we had, did we? We were like, we were just sort of fumbling around.
I feel like I'm going to sound like a bit of a grandpa now, but it's that idea of like, you need spaces of being bored and years of just waiting and hanging around for an adventure to be valuable. You know, if you don't have Luke growing up in that sort of farm with, Andy Beth and Uncle What's His Face, then then the adventure isn't as miraculous and it isn't as wonderful. If you have an adventure every week, I mean, and that's kind of a little bit a mirror to our sort of oversaturated lives, in which, I mean, I love it. I love having films at the touch of my fingertips and you know, books and all the rest of it coming every day when I order them. And music, I can listen to anything I want to listen without going to a shop and flipping through, you know, hundreds and hundreds of records. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I often find myself not knowing, you know, with the anxiety of choice and not just not knowing what to do, because I'm not educated by boredom anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, the boredom is sort of disappearing from the films themselves as an emotion, as something that the characters go through. Yeah, no, it's very true. There was something very, you look at the first sort of act of Star Wars is very, it's long. I mean, not much happens. There's lots of just poking around in the desert. It's very, and so yeah, you definitely, you really kind of get the feel of kind of Luke's boredom. But not so much. Yeah, I mean, do you get that? You don't really get, there isn't that in Dune, is there? But it is interesting how like they're very, how much they reflect one another, with those sort of the all that sand.
It gets everywhere, says Hayden Christensen in the Attack of the Clones. I think
Yeah.
as a sort of to wrap up, I think we don't often appreciate. I'm thinking about your book, Blockbusters. We don't tend to appreciate how lucky we are that we're living in a period which has in Denis Villeneuve and in Chris Nolan and in Greta Gerwig, really clever filmmakers who are making really entertaining films. I mean, I wouldn't put Oppenheimer necessarily in the entertainment category as a thing, but I mean, actually, I watched that film with a packed out an audience that kind of applauded at the end. I mean, which doesn't happen often in Italian cinemas, does happen occasionally, but and similarly with Barbie and similarly with Dune, packed audiences, both. And this is again very quite uncommon. Both original language and dubbed versions, because I usually go and see them dubbed first and then the original language later in the week when they come out. I think we're in a real there's a kind of golden age coming back to the cinema. If what do you think about that?
Yeah,
You're
I mean, I
throwing
think.
that one out.
Well, no, it's true. I mean, it may be, and to your point about like the scarcity factor of and boredom, the one of the most intriguing things I found out about Nolan, or that was, we talked about, was the fact that he was so lacking in media when he was growing up. And he was at boarding school, and there he would listen to the soundtrack, Van Gelis's soundtrack for Chariots of Fire, on his Walkman. Yeah, and he would recharge the batteries, putting them on the radiator. You know how you did that, just to get the batteries working again, and listen to the score after lights out in his dorm at Haileybury, the school that he was at. And something about that image of, and that was it in terms of audio visual escapes. And that's so the opposite of, the way things are now, the way my daughter experiences sort of movies and TV shows and whatnot. And it seems absolutely crucial to why he's been so as successful as he has, that he, I mean, A, I think there's this sense of it being extremely valuable, right? So in other words, like when he has that escape and is suspended in these synthesizers, this sort of bed of synthesizers after dark, and that's his escape. It becomes crucial, absolutely crucial that that work, right? That fantasy is successful and hard fought for, in that it just doesn't happen at the flick of a switch or the press of a button or every day even. And there's this almost Victorian, reminds me in some ways of like kind of the way that the Victorians used their imaginations, or had to use their imaginations, in these kind of situations where often maybe at schools, boarding schools, where they were miserable, or their only escape essentially was kind of inside their own head after lights out. So the sense of the difficulty of it, the value of it, and the importance of it working, that the fantasy holds true. I mean, all of those things I definitely get from his movies. Yeah, there's, with his both absolute desire that the fantasy immerses you and convinces you that it is happening, with IMAX, with the sound, with the score, it absolutely must work and to transport you. At the same time, this sense of sort of embattlement and sort of the sort of slight danger too of like kind of losing yourself in that world. And are you deluding yourself? Are you going into a dream world? Are you kind of lying to yourself? You know, all of those things are kind of in his work, right? And that comes, I think, partly from just the difficulty of access to you know, escapes. His escapes were so few and far between. So is it any surprise that he's become the filmmaker he has, where the escapes that he provides are singular, you know, to many, many people? They have the same place in our lives that, you know, Vangelis did for him, you know. And you know, Greta Gerwig too, I mean, I think, I don't know so much about her, you know, her personally, but I also know that, like, that she's going, that the work she's doing on those Narnia books is, I couldn't be more interested in seeing how that turns out. And and I can see that that's just a great, great match. So, you know, yeah, I mean, it's, we are sort of lucky, and maybe this is the sort of last of that, you know, generation, you know, of kids who've been bored. I mean, kids are bored, of course they are, no matter what. My kind of daughter's bored, no matter what you put in front of her, but like the bored, you know, for lack of access to, you know, to audiovisual escapes, you know, that's not going to bother them. Their boredom is slightly different. But yeah, it is kind of remarkable.
It's a sort of last generation of those analog to digital people.
Yeah.
And people like your daughter, my daughters, are going to be in many ways much more savvy and much more the digital natives who've never known they've never known a world without a mobile phone interaction or you know, a streaming service. So it's, for them, it's not obtrusive. It's not this, that, or the other. It's just the way things are.
Yeah.
And they will navigate it much better than we probably do. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah. But it's definitely, there's certainly, you're right, analog imaginations, you know, and it's, but you look at the popularity of both those filmmakers and you're like, oh, you know, because they're, you know, adored by the very generation that we're talking about of, and you realize that what they have experienced, their analog experience, has value to, you know, a film going generation who have everything at their fingertips. And I think it's precisely because of the things we're outlining of just the scarcity value of it, the rarity of it, the special value that's put on it. You know, in that sense, there's the two generations, they're definitely talking to one another. You know, like, it's not like that one generation is superseding the next. It's like they're finding each other's experience interesting. Nolan's, the fans are as interested in what goes on in Nolan's head and the way that, like, his, you know, it, you know, that sort of shapes his films, as we are by our daughters and trying to figuring out, like, what's going on inside their heads.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. If you succeed, let me know.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, Tom, yeah, you've been very generous with your time, and as always, absolutely, I could talk to you all day. It's so brilliant to pick your brains about the Oscars and about Dune Part Two, and we'll have to do this as soon as you like.
Please.
Paul Greengrass is the next book, so we're really looking forward to that.
And your Malick book. I don't know if you've, you know, had people on your show telling people like how good it is, but folks, get ready. It's a really good one. Yeah. So we've got to talk about that. You're going to have to take the back seat next time.
Absolutely. No, I'd love to. I'm actually thinking of doing a series of podcasts about Malick films.
There you go.
To sort of coincide with the release of the book. So you're more than invited to that.
Oh, yeah. Love to. Yeah.
Brilliant.
All right. Excellent.
Take care, Tom.
All right. Thanks, John.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.